This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My guests tonight include Lord Gawain Douglas and Cecilia Wallach. I'll also pay tribute to poet and teacher Jack Myers. First, Lord Gawain Douglas. As I say in my interview with him, it's not often I have a lord in my studio. Douglas, who was visiting from Deal in Kent, is a poet with a tremendously rich family history. Just for starts, he is the great-nephew of Lord Alfred Douglas, a celebrated poet and the lover of Oscar Wilde. The latest collection of poems by Douglas is Fortuna, published by Herla, an imprint of Alma Books Limited, in 2009. It's a distillation of his work from the last 36 years. Let's go now to my interview with Lord Gawain Douglas. Welcome, and thank you for coming all the way to Santa Rosa.
Oh, it's very nice to be here, Catherine. Thank you for asking me.
Well, first, it's not often that I have a lord in my house, so would you talk to us for just a minute about how someone gets that title? I know you're either born into it or earn it somehow.
Well, it started in the 9th century when a certain warrior went to assist one of the warrior kings who was fighting in the Lords of the Isles. And he went to assist this king, and the tide of battle was turned in favor of the king, and he was summoned afterwards to meet the king, and he was given the Clydesdale Valley for his services. And so this is when the title side of my family started.
Interesting. Thank you. I was alerted to your visit to Northern California by a notice of a reading you were going to give at the wonderful independent bookstore in San Francisco, yeah. Bird and Beckett.
Bird and Beckett, yes.
So you were there the other night. How did that go?
Oh, well, that was very interesting. The audience wasn't large, but it was select, and there were some people there who were very interested in T.S. Eliot. I don't think they'd heard of me very much, but it was very nice to combine doing The Wasteland, which is one of my favorite poems, one of the great poems of the 20th century, or perhaps mm-hmm. the greatest poem of the 20th century. And it was very nice to combine that with doing some of my own poetry afterwards, which I did.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I want to spend the majority of the show, this show, on your poetry, but first, we have to talk a little bit about your family history.
I was expecting that.
Yeah, it's so rich. We can't ignore it. I know that it was a Scottish border family that raided Northern England.
We used to ravage the Lowland women, basically.
Yeah.
Mostly at weekends.
Used to, right? Okay.
And the great character of my family at that time was the 14th century Black Douglas James.
Mm.
And such was the terror in which this black-haired, sallow-skinned chieftain was held that a refrain was chanted about him by northern mothers who were anxious to quieten their froward children. It went, hush thee, dinna fret thee, lest the Black Douglas come and get thee, as he usually did.
Oh, very good. Thank you. Well, you have a good number of examples of poets and fierceness in your family. And there's one story on the fierce side of the family about someone called the cannibalistic idiot. Who is that?
That was the third Earl of Douglas. And he was literally what you've just said, a cannibalistic idiot. And there were riots in Edinburgh at the time, and the staff of the house went out of the Queensbury house where they were all living, and this cannibalistic idiot escaped from his captors, or they'd run out into the street because of these riots, and he went into the kitchen and skewered a young cooking boy there and started to eat him.
Oh.
And so, as far as I know, that's the only cannibalistic side of my family, though we never know what's going to pop up in the future, I suppose.
I suppose. Well, I feel real comfortable here now. Thanks. Okay, well, you also do have a number of poets in your family history. One was Gavin Douglas. We have a Gavin in San Francisco,
really,
as you know.
Yes,
the mayor of San Francisco is Gavin Newsom.
Well, he was one of Scotland's leading Renaissance characters. He was a bishop. He was...
And this was the 16th century,
The 16th
correct?
Century yeah. bishop, yes, that's right. And he was perhaps one of Scotland's greatest poets, or not perhaps definitely one of Scotland's greatest poets. And he translated the Aeneidos of Virgil from Latin into Scottish metre, the unreadable, you might say, into the unspeakable. But he was a celebrated poet, and I have a copy at home of his great translation.
Well, another poet was William Douglas, who, I guess, though Lady John Scott tampered with the lyrics a bit later, he wrote the lyrics to Annie Laurie.
Yes, that's right.
Mm. And then your own father, Francis Queensberry, is well known for reciting Shakespeare, and he also recited the poetry of Lord Alfred Douglas that we'll get to in a moment.
Yes, indeed. Did you want me to comment on William Douglas at all?
Sure.
And I mean,
absolutely.
Well, I'll sing you a bit of the song if you like.
I would love it.
Maxwell ten Braes a bonny, where early falls the dew, and it's there that Annie Laurie gied me her promise true. Gied me her promise true, that ne'er forgot will be, and for Bonnie Annie Laurie I'd lay hey madoon and dee.
Wonderful. So those were the lyrics to, that was a song, Annie Laurie, and the lyrics were written by William Douglas, your ancestor.
That's right.
Thank you so much. Well, of course, one of the most famous ancestors is your great uncle, Lord Alfred Douglas, who, though a poet, and we will get to talk about his poetry for a little bit, he's mostly known, at least for now, as Bosie, Oscar Wilde's lover, who played a part in destroying Wilde's life. Bosie's father was the Marquess of Queensberry, unhappy to say the least with the relationship between Wilde and his son, and to the extent he followed them around until he could accuse Oscar Wilde of
sodomy. That was my great-grandfather, the ninth Marquess, who hounded Oscar Wilde into prison. As you know, he was imprisoned in May 1894 for what was then called gross indecency.
Mm-hmm.
But Bosie has always been written off as the bad boy who ruined Oscar Wilde, and few people realise the true nature of their friendship, really, and the fact that he was a remarkable man of letters, a distinguished historian, and a very fine poet in his own right. In fact, in some ways, his poetry was remarkably original because he went against the whole trend of modern poetry with its exploratory tendencies and went back to the antique form of the sonnet. But the bad news is always the good news. Oscar and Bosie had a wonderful friendship in many ways. It was one of the great loves of history, I suppose, when all is said and done. And when Alfred Douglas, when Oscar Wilde died in 1900, Bosie realised what an irreplaceable friend he'd lost, what a great figure the world had lost, and wrote one of his best sonnets, the Dead Poet. And it's not only a fine sonnet, but it's one of our best records of Oscar Wilde's golden voice, his magical power with words. Because when Oscar spoke, the world fell silent.
Mm-hmm.
That was his greatest thing, his conversation. He talked forever, and you wanted him to talk forever.
Right.
This is the poem Alfred Douglas wrote following Oscar Wilde's death. I dreamed of him last night. I saw his face, all radiant and unshadowed of distress. And as of old, in music measureless, I heard his golden voice, and marked him trace under the common thing the hidden grace, and conjure wonder out of emptiness, till mean things put on beauty like a dress, and all the world was an enchanted place. And then, methought, outside a fast-locked gate, I mourned the loss of unrecorded words, forgotten tales and mysteries half-said, wonders that might have been articulate, and voiceless thoughts like murdered singing birds. And so I woke and knew that he was dead.
It turns out that Bosie himself, and I don't know how many people realize this, he also spent a number of months in jail, didn't he?
He did indeed,
for
yes.
Libeling Winston Churchill. You don't do that. What happened?
Well, Bosie was one of these people who, apart from his poetry, should never have put pen to paper. He was a charming person, wonderful conversationist, most amusing, but he was also a tremendous litigant. He was always suing people. He was bringing up political causes and things which he didn't know a great deal about and getting himself into trouble in the courts. And he got it into his head that Winston Churchill had accepted a bribe in the First World War to publish a false report on something called the Battle of Jutland. And so that money could be made on the New York Stock Exchange by Jewish financiers. And it was all complete nonsense, and the only thing you can say in Alfred Douglas's favour is that he genuinely believed that what he was doing was true. Mm-hmm. And he went on and on at the matter like a little terrier, and Winston Churchill was very forbearing at first, but eventually he had to defend his name, and the matter came to court, and it was quickly shown that Alfred Douglas was talking through his top hat, and he was giving the sternest of dressings down by the judge at the time, Mr. Justice Avery. And quite correctly, he was sent down to Wormwood Scrubs prison for 6 months.
And he wrote a poem there, In Excelsis. Right?
That's right. This was a turning point in his psychology, really. He wrote a sequence of... He came to confront himself in prison, as all prisoners must do, and he learned humility, and he wrote his greatest cycle of sonnets, In Excelsis, a cycle of 17 sonnets. And he emerged from prison a kinder, less confrontational man. And later...
He had been tamed.
He'd been tamed by his experiences. Mm. They weren't such severe experiences as Oscar Wilde's, who did 2 years hard labour.
Right.
But they were nevertheless pretty severe experiences in those days.
It does seem that Bosie got a lot of, if not all, the blame for...
He did.
Oscar Wilde going to prison. And yet, when you read the transcript of the trials, you know that's not exactly the case. Oscar Wilde did play a part in it himself. He was
very much so.
His witty self in court in the beginning until he realized was serious.
I'm great friends with Merlin Holland, Oscar Wilde's grandson.
Who has the trial...
The transcripts, yes.
Thank you.
And... we had a debate recently in Oxford University at Magdalen College, where Bosie was at university, about did Alfred Douglas destroy Oscar Wilde? And then the unanimous thing at the end of the debate was they destroyed each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a fatal love affair, fatal friendship, and they brought each other down.
Yeah.
But they were both great artists. They were muses to each other. Mm-hmm. I very much doubt either Bosie's poetry or Oscar's plays would have had their bite or their finesse if it hadn't been for the other person.
Interesting. Yeah.
Wilde spoke of the bright sword play of Bosie's wit. You know, it must have been wonderful hearing them together.
And Oscar Wilde did believe that Bosie wrote very good poetry, as did George Bernard Shaw.
George Bernard Shaw, when he received Alfred Douglas's collected poems in 1939, wrote to him and he said, "For this may all thy sins be forgiven thee."
Well, I think it's your turn now. Let's turn to your book of poems, Fortuna, which includes poems that you've written over the past 36 years. And the book is divided into several sections, interestingly to me, not collected by date. These are the sections: On the Beach, 1972 to 1996, The Seasons, 1993 to 2002, Gin, 2002 to 2005, and finally Tonic, 2006 to 2008. But before all of this, there's a prose poem that serves as a type of introduction, The Place for Poetry, and it might have been called anything like, you know, When Lightning Strikes or When the Muse Enters, correct? Would you like to read The Place for Poetry?
Okay, well, this is The Place of Poetry, which I suppose is, it's about the essentially unconscious, unexplainable process, which is writing poetry or doing anything artistic. T.S. Eliot, when asked what his poetry meant, said, I've absolutely no idea. I know even less than you. And I suppose it's just an attempt to explain this trance-like state in which some sort of creative effort becomes possible. The place of poetry. I live in a big white townhouse in an Edwardian square by the sea in Kent. It has pleasant gardens with tennis courts and croquet lawns and a nice clubhouse. I often go there and play tennis in the summer, and every day, winter and summer, I go to the pebbled shore and gaze across the waters. Mostly they are grey and dull, and one could be anywhere. Sometimes they are blue and sunstruck, and then I'm in the best place in the world. I have a kind wife, and children who've all left home, and I go to work every day and come back late and eat and drink rather a lot, and that's my life, really. But oh, I nearly forgot. At the top of my house there's a further floor, a sort of attic, which is always locked and which has a hidden key. Most of the time this key is very difficult to find. Sometimes I even forget it exists. Then one day, puzzled, walking up the stairs perhaps, or in a brown study, looking out into the rain, I'll see it shining somewhere, beckoning me. Then I'll pick it up quite naturally, as though it's been there all the time, and climb the stairs and unlock the door to that other place, the place where poetry is. I cannot tell you any more about it or what it means or how it came about. Your guess is quite as good as mine.
Thank you. In the first section of your book, a poem called Lines to My Father appears. And we mentioned earlier that your father was famous for reciting the sonnets of Shakespeare. I couldn't help but wonder if the word will, repeating as it does in this poem, is a type of pun. And would you go ahead and answer that and read
I'll
the poem?
I'll answer that question directly. No, it wasn't a type of pun, but you've made it one another. you've recreated my poem for me. But my father was very celebrated as a reciter of Shakespeare in an amateur way, and he used to do this at the great country houses of England after dinner, sitting back over a brandy and a cigar and delighting the sitting company with his great knowledge of Shakespeare. It was rumoured he knew all the sonnets by heart. And he died when I was six, so I didn't know him at all well. I've got one cracked recording on an old turntable record of him reciting a sonnet on Australian radio in the 1940s. He was very nervous, I think, and he got one or two bits wrong. But he had a unique voice, and that's been a great inspiration to me, just this one record of his voice. Lines to My Father. Father, father, far away from me, will I see you, will I? Will we meet then, you and I, meet in the unending sea? Father, father, so far apart from me, further than the eye can see, further than the mind can be, so far, so far. But father, father, come we closer, you and I now, closer as I end the journey, closer as the river widens, as it nears the endless sea. And will my spirit know you, father, or will it, so your son can touch you, father, touch your spirit with my spirit, when we merge together, father, merge in the unending sea.
I mentioned the kind of the macabre element that shows up in your poetry now and then, and one of the more interesting poems to me in the first section is Removal of Parts. Would you read that poem and then tell us where that particular poem came from?
This poem, Removal of Parts, which I'm fairly surprised to have been asked to recite because I don't know how many people actually relate to it or even like it, but it's essentially insane, so not amenable to explanation, I don't think. It's someone who's extremely uncomfortable in his own body and in his own brain and really wishes to remove himself from the whole procedure. He had lost confidence in his parts. They didn't belong. They were not his. They became smaller, deceitful. Most especially it applied to hands and feet, to head. And those other parts that had a function he had never understood. Mysterious. Dogs at the door, desperate for out, their independent life infuriated him. They had no right. Offensive. The way they waved or turned or smiled, demonstrated, even spoke. The rest of him was all right. It stayed in place, continued normally, behaved. But those parts. One day he took a knife and cut them off, starting with the feet and ending with the head. Removal of parts. Satisfactory.
Ugh. Maybe that comes from that other bloodline in your family that we talked about. Well, in the next section, Seasons, there is a poem called The Room that seems to echo back to the place for poetry, but it could also have nothing to do with it.
It does perhaps a reference back to that preface I said earlier, but it's about the essential unknowableness of the other person. The people we know and love are like icebergs. The bit one knows is the white bit on the surface, the bit one doesn't, of the bit which goes deep below. And it's about the fragility and changeability of relationships. To remain constant in love, I think, is perhaps the greatest human challenge, because both parties change. Mm-hmm. And one has to seek out the changeless in each other. The room. Suddenly the door was locked, and the key to that room, the place we used to go, know each other now and then, was hidden. Who put it away? I don't know. But the same person hid the room as well. All at once it was missing from the top of the stairs, too. Gone. Sometimes I meet you on the landing, muttering about the key. You seem to think if you find it, you will find the room again. Wrong. Our eyes meet in a secret pool of sadness and puzzlement. But we both know it's too late now, and is forbidden.
The segment of your book, Seasons, of course, has many poems named after months and seasons. The entire book does, really. But they still manage to surprise. I read the title, Spring, and made some immediate assumptions. But then as an ardent dog lover, I was pleasantly surprised. Would you go ahead and read this particular poem, Spring?
Yes, I will do, yes. Shakespeare said the seven ages in man, seven decades, and I think we have about seven dogs in those decades.
At least.
And I think I'm on about my sixth dog now. But the dogs do the simple things well. They do living and dying and eating and sleeping simply and well, and which we don't. I think our complexity is one of our failures.
Mm-hmm.
And so this poem is about the simplicity of a dog which is dying. She sits in the garden, aged since yesterday. Suddenly, dogs do that. Her minutes and her hours speed past mine. My hours are her days. Her white beard and brown eyes are infinitely gentle. May covers her, a favourite coat of sun. She draws me, poor unsettled beast, into her circle of age, her slow, swift process of farewell. Her body understands. She knows more than I, my failure as an animal and man. Can she forgive that? The question dissolves in its own stupidity and her eyes' incredible softness. Affection between us deepens. She knows, I know, our years are measured in each other. I've counted out my days in many dogs, but she can only put her faith in me.
There are a number of deeply romantic poems in this book as well. You cover a lot in this book of poems. The poem December is really a lovely example of this.
I suppose it's some profound nonsense to speak of eternal love. I mean, nothing really could be briefer, but something remains of us, I suppose. And what remains may as well remain together. My dust mingle with your dust. So let us take the greatest pleasure known to us, of flesh on flesh, and skin on skin, its taste through skin. arms intertwined in stillness, marbled in tranquillity. So still we lie here now. And in this shard, this fleck of time, will be here still, when stars are lost and space is dust inside a stone.
There's another poem that I hadn't planned on asking you to read, but I'm going to, and that is Stars.
Well, that was written really to my son, although it doesn't say so in the book, but he'd left for Japan, and it was the first time that he'd gone away from home. And as all parents must, I felt an incredible feeling of loss and desolation once he'd gone. So I went out and communicated with the night sky. Stars. It's good that I've been brought down by your leaving, as far as possible, right to the base of myself. From this point I can look and see the sky. Night and day the same, your face is there, darkly bright with me. And those stars, endless, endlessly consoling, come close, tight inside my chest, and shine.
You also display your sense of humor in a good number of poems in the book. Two examples are A to Z and a Bit of French, which is one poem, and Big Brother. You really give yourself license to be a bit silly and to play with language in the latter poem. So would you read these two poems?
A to Z is the name of the London map, actually. And the London, you know, so if you've got an A to Z, you know your way all around London. And when you fall in love, you get a sense of the wider landscape, I think. When your wrists feel like water and the sky touches your face, you may be in that zone. I met my wife-to-be on one occasion on a park, on a bridge in St. James's Park in London, and we seemed to become part of the city, its hills and its districts. A to Z and a bit French. Kissing you, I knew the city. In your hand, I saw its skies. Your head was Highgate, your feet Blackheath, and your tummy Battersea. Sorry. And your back, just where my finger strayed upon it, was Trafalgar Square. Your heart beat in St. James's Park. I met you on the bridge there and kissed your lips, and the swans, a pair of them, drifted towards spring.
It's really a beautiful little poem. But there is that one line that struck me as humorous. Your tummy, Battersea, sorry.
Well, that's because Battersea Power Station in London is a huge, ugly, fat thing looking over the river. And so I thought I had to apologize for this slight...
Yes, I think that's a good idea.
Slight lapse of taste, you know. That was all it was.
And then there's the poem, Big Brother.
Well, we live in a surveillance society, as you know, and words, thoughts, diets, salt, fat intake are all noted. Mm-hmm. And we are most profoundly not ourselves because we are being watched all the time. And we also become watchers. And on the seafront where I live in the UK, we watch the doggies poo. The poo police are watching you. Beware of what you do. They watch your hands, they watch your bags, and where you place the poo. And if indeed you pick it up or stand there skulkingly, pretending you see a pleasant view across the briny sea. Alack, unhappy modern man, for you no longer blue, the lissom sky or green gauge sea, your eyes are glued in poo. Alack, depleted Englishman who fought at Waterloo, you wouldn't do much good there now, too busy scooping poo. But we are all policemen now, and watch the doggies poo. See if our neighbour picks it up, or just admires the view. The poo police are watching us, beware of what we do. Their eyes aglint with dread intent, watch where we pop the poo. I fear I must be going now, I've many things to do. But first of all, there's something small. I think I spy a poo.
Now, that last little verse isn't in the book.
No,
did you just add that?
Just put that in.
Very good. Well, those are fun poems. This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to Lord Gawain Douglas. Let's move on to a different energy. We'd have time for just a couple of more poems. Mm. I would like you to read The Painter, and then we're going to close with something fun, I think.
Okay. The Painter really is just about possibility, and I think possibility is the most wonderful thing. And it's always there, I hope, and the possibility at any age to do something, to change, and to feel a latent talent within oneself, even if it's too late to do much about it. And really, it's a slightly autobiographical poem, this, because I've always wanted to paint, and I've never done it. And so I had a go, and this poem, The Painter, was about the feeling that induced. It was just the feel of the brush. Not that he could paint or draw, he was too old for that. Just the feel of it in his hand. A possibility. Only this. Like the sky opening in some strange way, night into morning, into remote colour after a storm. Just the feel of it gave him delight. Holding the brush, he drew a line.
Thank you. In a review of your work, John Calder states that some poems are, quote, unsuitable for reading aloud because they comment in a marginal way on their own discovery. And as an example of that, I'm assuming he may be referring to a poem called Words. But I have to say, I just don't agree with him. I think this poem can be read aloud, and it can be read by one person. But it might be fun to have two voices. Shall we?
Yeah, let's have a go.
Okay. So let me get the poem here.
Which bit are you going to take?
Well, how about if I just read the lines on the right.
On the right.
And so the last word I will read will be unwords.
Yes, and will you read that at the same time as I read the parallel thing?
You bet.
At the same time.
You bet.
Words become difficult, strange, dry. A course
without door.
Water. They are not
enclosed,
what they
thick,
say.
Turbulent,
they
confused.
Are not what
deafening,
they sound
deadening. They kill
anymore.
With noise.
They have become unwords. We have to thin them out, prune, find light between the letters, tone beneath the sound. In the desert, wandering, we found them, moonlit under cliff, by tree, fireside. Questions formed, burned into the future. Now, in the city, we lost them by roadside, pavement or river, grey, grey, grey. On telephones and screens, they died. Those first words.
So before we go, you mentioned that when you were at Bird and Beckett the other night, you recited T.S. Eliot. Would you like to do a little recitation right now of Eliot?
Well, that would be a great pleasure and honor, and thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been a great experience, and Eliot is one of the main poetic influences in my life. It's paradoxical because Alfred Douglas, my great uncle, thought he was absolutely a non-poet, and his blood boiled at the mere mention of the name of T.S. Eliot. So it's rather odd that I should be promoting T.S. Eliot, the American poet, as I do a lot nowadays. Here is a page or so of The Wasteland, which is the great seminal poem of the 20th century. And as you know, when it came out in the 1920s, it broke barriers in people's minds and freed them to understand poetry in a completely different way, and freed the whole business of modern poetry from the shackles of the past. The Burial of the Dead. April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprised us. Coming over the Starnberger See with a shower of rain, we stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten, and drank coffee and talked for an hour. Bin gar keine Russin, stamm aus Litauen, echt Deutsch. And when we were children, staying at the Archduke's, my cousin's, he took me out on a sled, and I was frightened. He said, Marie, Marie, hold on tight. And down we went. In the mountains, there you feel free. I read much of the night and go south in the winter. What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images, where the sun beats and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Only there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of this red rock, and I will show you something different from either your shadow at morning striding behind you, or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. Frisch weht der Wind der Heimat zu, mein irisch Kind, wo weilest du? You gave me hyacinths first a year ago. They called me the hyacinth girl. Yet when we came back late from the hyacinth garden, your arms full and your hair wet, I could not speak and my eyes failed. I was neither living nor dead, and I knew nothing, looking into the heart of light, the silence. Oed und leer das Meer.
That was Lord Gawain Douglas reciting from memory the beginning of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. You know the whole thing by heart, I know, so I'm sorry we don't have time for all of it. But thank you so much again for coming to be on the show tonight. It was great to have you.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And this is Catherine Hastings. If you missed the opportunity to hear Cecilia Wallach read at the Word Temple Poetry Series last year, here's your chance to experience this fine poet when she reads from her latest collection, Carpathia, published by BOA Editions in 2009. Wallach is the author of 5 award-winning collections of poems. Carpathia, titled after the mountainous region in Eastern Europe of her father's family origins, contains some truly beautiful lyrics. Maxine Kuman says of Wallach's work, "To write movingly about love in an era infused with hate requires a special gift, nostalgia hard-edged with realism. Wallach has that gift." Founding director of Summer Poetry in Idlewild and of the Paris Poetry Workshop, lecturer in the Creative Writing Program at the University of Southern California, Wallach's poems have been translated into French, German, and Polish. Recent prose has been published in Ukrainian. Here now is Cecilia Wallach reading from Carpathia.
Fireflies. And these are my vices. Impatience, bad temper, wine, the more than occasional cigarette, an almost unquenchable thirst to be kissed, a hunger that isn't hunger but something like fear, a staunching of dread, and a taste for bitter gossip of those who've wronged me, for bitterness, and flirting with strangers and saying sweetheart to children whose names I don't even know, and driving too fast and not being Buddhist enough to let insects live in my house, or those cute little toy-like mice whose soft gray bodies and sticky traps I carry, lifeless, out to the trash, and that I sometimes prefer the company of a book to a human being, and humming and living inside my head, and how as a girl I trailed a slow-hipped ant at twilight across the lawn, and learn to catch fireflies in my hands, to smear their sticky, still-pulsing flickering onto my fingers and earlobes like jewels. That's a poem from my Aunt Barbara, my late great Aunt Barbara, who was married to my Uncle Andy Boog, also called Andy Boog, which translates into Uncle God. And she was the first woman I ever heard described as a floozy. And I thought it would be great to grow up to be like her. This is another poem about childhood. Faith. I once believed in ridiculous things, the ghosts of swans, the wings of death, that fire leapt from the tip of the match, a living thing, in magic, luck. Was I wrong to slip sugar under my pillow at night, wrong to kiss photographs? I believed in the kind of God who granted wishes, any God, in trees with their terrible faces of bark. Even on my knees, I believed what I'd lost would be given back. Whole rosaries of grief, the painted saints breathing when I breathed. What makes a child who scratched her own hands until they're raw have faith like that? Light in the gravel she skidded across, light in her blood and the jewel of the scab. When I look back, I see how foolish it was to try to shape those clouds. I lay in the grass. Birds fell into the sky. The dead were fruitful. They multiplied. This is a poem for my father, whom I find myself still thinking about on a daily basis. And he died, I think it's 10 years ago, 12 years ago now. 7 years after your death, I'm still waiting for you to appear. In the feathery clouds, my heaven-gone father, if there's a heaven, it's rush hour here. Across the street, the leafy campus, calm and grave in late autumn sun, but the traffic's brisk, a bright stream flashing past, too swift to risk, so I wait. Warm cup of milky tea clutched in one hand, folders and textbooks tucked under my arm, the light unchanging, O world without end. And I'm thinking I'll stand here forever, stuck when a friend drives past waving, calling my name, and I can't wave back, so I raise my cup. And then some old man in a truck waves too, just an old man in a battered red pickup, but I laugh, raise my cup to him, thinking of you. And you touch my cheek then, or seem to, a breeze that sighs, what a mess you've made of your life. Married twice, twice divorced, then your voice says, you'll love again, honey, there's time. And the bright stream parts, so I make a run for it, cross unharmed to the other side. This is for my friends Pierre and Isabelle. Pantoum, Le Jardin d'Isabelle. The love of my lover for his wife, his name being stone, the word for stone, and her name like a flower, Isabel, who has thrown herself into the garden this summer, made it a paradise. His name is the stone I polished in my mouth all winter long, Pierre, as in Peter, who stands at the gate, who welcomes me into the garden this summer she's made a paradise. And I come bearing the little sin of sweet Alyssum. Love them both. Pierre, she calls Peter, who stands at the gate. And Isabel coming toward me now, knee-deep in the shimmering grass. I have brought them the little sin of sweet Alyssum. Love them both. And beloved, welcomed, slip into the shade between them, kissed by the child who's come rushing toward me. Waist deep in the shimmering grass, and lifted into my arms, names me Tanta of weeds and wind, and beloved, laughing, slips into the shade between us, blessed, the love of this man for this woman, and this woman for this child, and lifting out of my arms the crushed bouquet of weeds and wind, and calling it luck, the glass I shatter in the offering of wine. This man who loves this woman, who loves this woman, who loves this child, offers me a place at love's long table, not cast out, and calling it luck, the glass I shatter in the offering of wine, and the love of my lover for his wife, and my place among them, here at love's long table, not cast out, I name every flower Isabel. If what we love turns to glass, how do we keep it safe? I'd like to make something tender for both of us, something at least to put into your hands, something like those flowers I saw by the side of the road in the Polish countryside, though some might have called them weeds, as I might have called them once. But that summer evening, just after the storm, I walked along naming them to myself. Buttercup, thistle, poppy, homely, oh lovely dandelion. I thought them jewel-like, there in the high grass, blue mist rising off the fields, men on bicycles wobbling home, everything softening in the blur of twilight, wood smoke, drizzle, sky. I thought then, as I think now, so where's the line between beauty and sorrow? Where's the line between terror and joy? How the small daughter of my friends had run out the open door of the house, screaming and laughing into the rain. How your mother, still beautiful, still, had hobbled each day down the road to the store. How all those years you watched her disappear until she disappeared for good. How my father, those same years adrift, drifted too far in his ship of bones. Then only the smell of flowers above that bed where he'd lain to die. So I take your suffering, you take mine, we take it up, shall this be a bouquet? That evening in Poland I walked for an hour, away from then back toward the church. I called to no one, and no one called to me, though the warm room was waiting, the bread. I would give you this now, the pale green dome, the meadow, the quiet house, lights coming on, how the child in her sleep breathed the breath of birds, how the little boat of my heart goes out. The silk of longing is never worth what we are paid. O lamb, O lonely in your rooms above the childless neighbors too, the blue of afternoon went on and on like winter, didn't it? The first lights flickering at dusk along the street to make you sad. You took the subway into town, then taxied back, your meager store of cash diminishing again. And still awake at 4 a.m., you wanted anything but this, the silent bed, the empty kitchen, birdsong startling the trees. Open your hand and kiss your palm. That's my kiss, as real as salt. Then turn your head and kiss your shoulder, pale as snow, then warm as milk. The day turns over when we sleep. We need our sleep. Take comfort there. I wish for you the book of childhood's secrets, love's dark stairs. I climbed them once to you, would climb again toward you now, and keep you company a while, and lie down next to you, O lamb. This is Postcard with Sarah, to Sarah, from a bridge in Paris. Which? It's late, and we've stopped to lean against the rail of the Pont Marie, or the Pont Louis-Philippe, or some other bridge. Which bridge? It's cloudy, the moon is veiled, or it's clear, but we can't see the Tour Eiffel. Below us, on the quay, there's a kind of party going on. Someone's about to fall into the river, or about to plunge, or he's being pushed. Or no, it was only a game after all. See, they're laughing. A joke among friends. My friend who leans beside me is saying she wants another child. Now she's sure of it. A boy. Or another girl like the girl she has. Or different, more like the father. Or darker this time, like herself. What does it matter? Either one of us could be the other sometimes, in shadow, like this. She sighs. We both stare down at the glittering river, knowing we'll find no answers there. We've agreed there's no right or wrong, no answers at all when it comes to love. And there are so many we might have loved, might yet love, or love again. Her husband, she says, still recovering from the shock of her being his wife. I'm not winking, it's just my eye. And we're falling down laughing, we're standing here. So beautiful, one of us says, or the other thinks, the river, the wind. It's cold and our coats are thin. It's spring, and the blossoms the trees breathe scatter like petals of snow at our feet. It's the middle of our lives and night, and we walk toward everything. Carpathia. Having rinsed off the soot and stink of the Polish train, having sung with the child, having eaten and laughed and wept, had my vodka with apple juice, my bread, having walked through the fields at dusk and into the forest and back again, meadows of buttercups, thistles with bristling heads, the first blue cornflowers of June, having opened my arms to the sky falling back on itself in my dizziness, having taken the small purple berries that dropped from the wild bush into my palm, Siberian berries like tiny plums, put their sweet, bitter inkiness onto my tongue. Having failed and failed at love, having gone anyway, breath after breath, having trusted the world to be kind and stood in the doorway and listened for wolves and heard my own dead in the high grass whispering, beloved, beloved, beloved.
This is Catherine Hastings. You just heard Cecilia Wallach reading from her book, Carpathia. Before Wallach, you heard Lord Gawain Douglas being interviewed and reading from his book, Fortuna. I'm going to close tonight's program with a too short tribute to the late poet Jack Myers, who died in November of 2009. Jack Myers, professor of English and creative writing at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, was the author of 18 books of and about poetry. His most recent collections included Routine Heaven, the college textbook, The Poet's Portable Workshop, and The Glowing River, New and Selected Poems, winner of the 2001 Violet Crown Award for Best Literary Book in Texas. Other popular titles by Jack were One-on-One, Blindsided, winner of the 1993 Texas Institute of Letters Award, and an anthology of contemporary poetry co-edited with Roger Weingarten. New American Poets. Jack's many honors included two fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, multiple university residencies, first place in the National Poetry Series, and selection as the 2003 to 2004 Poet Laureate of Texas. Jack served as the co-vice president for AWP from 1993 to 95, as well as chairman of the Writers' Garret, a Dallas literary center founded by his wife, Thea Temple. Jack's writing lives on, seeking to discover the extraordinary within the ordinary by fusing Eastern influences to Jungian psychology while being grounded in an ironic humor and working-class sensibility. I'm going to read a few poems now by Jack Myers. The Glowing River. The spin I'd put on my father's wanting to be alone would be to compare him to solitary males of the wild kingdom, whose nobility and courage disdained the flock, the herd, the whole squawking barbecue of fear and indecision. But when I look his isolation in the eye, I see he couldn't love easily, though he felt so deeply he spent all his life resisting it, like the nuclear power plant that recycled so much warm water it choked on weeds, so they stocked the lake with weed-eating fish, who, in my mind, prospered so well that I knew soon something larger, more ominous and foreign would arrive. They would gather at the mouth of the underwater river, and, basking in the heat of its eerie greenish glow, fall asleep under the spell of an alien sun. You see the problem, how the unnatural, over time, spawns something stranger than we'd meant, which is why I'm studying my nature through what must have happened to my father. Toxic secrets beyond the mouth of the glowing river I'll never learn, but like all sons have put my faith in. Incarnation. A friend of mine won't eat pork because pigs are so intelligent. Another won't eat anything higher than an egg, and still another won't eat anything with a face. But I've seen gnats fall in love with other gnats across a crowded room. I've seen a single seed lift tons of wood above its head. And don't some of my best ideas come from meditating on rocks? So, please, whoever has the true and secret knowledge, tell us what to eat. Remind us when we lift our knife and fork in praise of our transcendence over everything beneath us, that there are forces that can crystallize mist into exquisite works of ice that love melting back to mist again. Remind us before we eat that we are monumental, momentary works of mist, and that everything and everyone who has ever existed has brought us here. Poem Against Good Health. I quit all my bad habits so I could grow old, and one day say something big enough to climb into and close like a box. That's how 1 year went up in smoke, waiting for whatever I did smart to harden into words, while the nothing behind me and the nothing before me marched forward in their place. All my consciousness focused on what was different, so I forgot the main thing, like when you spot a fly in the room, the whole room softens and disappears, which is how I became what I wanted to change. Now it's impossible even to be simple, but I've added years to my life, which is as invisible as if it never existed, and everyone's so proud of me. Cirrus. I'd like to leave a lighter imprint on the world than I'd formerly meant, just a scent, not the thud of the thing steaming on a plate. Instead of, "I told you so," let my epitaph be the glance, the edge, the mist, the delicately attenuated swirl of an innuendo instead of a thunderhead. The rain that fell when I was ambitious seemed conspiringly rushed in my way, but the same rain today tastes of here and now because of where it's been. I'd like to be gentle with small, great things. They are larger than what we think we came here for. I'd like to be an eye of light that opens the air and burns beyond ambition, like the sun that can't see us and is beyond our reach, yet is in us a trillion times over. Those were a few poems by the late Jack Myers, M-Y-E-R-S. Jack lived from November 29, 1941, and left us way too soon on November 23, 2009. I had the great pleasure and honor of being his student at Vermont College. I want to thank my guest tonight, Lord Gawain Douglas, who was interviewed first on this show, and Cecilia Wallach, who read from her book, Carpathia. Join me again next month on Word Temple, the third Wednesday at 7 p.m. And if you have any questions or comments about tonight's show, you can contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening. Thank you.